One lifted her head, dark eyes searching north into the trees, stomping her right front foot. Then the left. The others looked up, then whistled an alarm. Instantly, Kaya's good eye probed the forest for signs of chase or some other predator. But all was quiet. Perhaps the breeze had startled them. They stopped stomping, but slowly moved away into the tall grass, leaving Kaya alone and uneasy. She scanned the meadow again for intruders, but the listening and searching sucked all her energy, so she went back into the cabin, dug sweaty cheese from her bag, then slumped on the floor and ate mindlessly, touching her bruised cheek. Her face, arms, and legs were cut and smeared with bloody grit, knees scratched and throbbing. She sobbed, fighting shame, suddenly spitting the cheese out in a chunky wet spray. She'd brought this on herself, consorting unchaperoned. A natural wanting had led her unmarried to a cheap hotel, but still unsatisfied. Sex under flashing neon lights, marked only by blood smudged across the sheets like animal tracks. Chase had probably bragged about their doings to everyone. No wonder people shunned her. She was unfit. Disgusting. As the half-moon appeared between fast-moving clouds, she searched through the small window for man-like forms, hunched and sneaking. Finally, she crawled into Tate's bed and slept under his quilt, waking often, listening for footsteps, then pulling the soft fabric closely around her face. More crumbling cheese for breakfast. Her face darkened to green-purple now, eye swollen like a boiled egg, neck stove up. Parts of her upper lip twisted grotesquely. Like Ma, monstrous, afraid to go home. In sudden clarity, Kaya saw what Ma had endured and why she left. "Ma, Ma," she whispered. "I see. Finally, I understand why you had to leave and never come back. I'm sorry I didn't know that I couldn't help you." Kaya dropped her head and sobbed, then jerked her head up and said, "I will never live like that. A life wondering when and where the next fist will fall." She hiked home that afternoon. But even though she was hungry and needed supplies, she didn't go to Jumpin's. Chase might see her there. Besides, she didn't want anyone, especially Jumpin, to see her battered face. After a simple meal of hard bread and smoked fish, she sat on the edge of her porch bed, staring through the screen. Just at that moment, she noticed a female praying mantis stalking along a branch near her face. The insect was plucking moths with her articulated forelegs, then chewing them up, their wings still flapping in her mouth. A male mantis, head high and proud as a pony, paraded along to court her. She appeared interested, her antennae flailing about like wands. His embrace might have been tight or tender, Kaya couldn't tell. But while he probed about with his copulatory organ to fertilize her eggs, the female turned back her long, elegant neck and bit off his head. He was so busy humping, he didn't notice. His neck stump waved about as he continued his business, and she nibbled on his thorax, and then his wings. Finally, his last foreleg protruded from her mouth as his headless, heartless lower body copulated in perfect rhyme. Female fireflies draw in strange males with dishonest signals and eat them. Mantis females devour their own mates. Female insects, Kaya thought, know how to deal with their lovers. After a few days, she boated into the marsh, exploring areas Chase wouldn't know, but was jumpy and alert, making it difficult to paint. Her eye was still puffed around a thin slit, and the bruise had leached its nauseated colors across half her face, Much of her body throbbed with pain. At the chirp of a chipmunk, she whirled around, listened keenly to the caws of crows. A language before words were, when communication was simple and clear. And wherever she went, mapped an escape route in her mind. Chapter 42. A Cell. 1970. Murky shafts of light streamed through the tiny window of Kaya's cell. She stared at dust motes, dancing silently in one direction as though following some dreamy leader. When they hit the shadows, they vanished. Without the sun, they were nothing. She pulled the wooden crate, her only table, under the window, which was 7 feet above the floor. Dressed in a gray jumpsuit with County Inmate printed on the back, she stood on the crate and stared at the sea, just visible beyond the thick glass and bars. White caps slapped and spat, and pelicans, heads turning for fish, flew low over the waves. If she stretched her neck far to the right, she could see the dense crown of the marsh's edge. Yesterday, she had seen an eagle dive and twist toward a fish. The county jail consisted of 6 12-by-12 cells in a cement block one-story building behind the sheriff's office at the edge of town. The cells were in a row down the length of the building, only on one side, so inmates couldn't see one another. 3 of the walls were damp cement blocks. The 4th was made of bars, including the locked door. Each cell had a wooden bed with a bumpy cotton mattress, a feather pillow, sheets, 1 gray wool blanket, a sink, and a wooden crate table, plus a toilet. Over the sink was not a mirror, but a picture of Jesus, framed there by the ladies' Baptist auxiliary. The only allowance made for her, the first female inmate, other than overnighters, in years, was a gray plastic curtain that could be pulled around the sink and toilet. For 2 months before the trial, she'd been held in this cell without bail because of her failed attempt to escape the sheriff in her boat. Kaya wondered who started using the word cell instead of cage. There must have been a moment in time when humanity demanded this shift. Self-scratched red webbing streaked her arms. For untracked minutes, sitting on her bed, she studied strands of her hair, plucking them like feathers, as the gulls do. Standing on the crate, craning her neck toward the marsh, she recalled an Amanda Hamilton poem. Broken gull of Brandon Beach. Winged soul, you dance the skies and startled dawn with shrilling cries. You followed sails and braved the sea, then caught the wind back to me. You broke your wing, it dragged the land and etched your mark upon the sand. When feathers break, you cannot fly. But who decides the time to die? You disappeared, I know not where, but your wing marks still linger there. A broken heart cannot fly, but who decides the time to die? Even though the inmates couldn't see one another, the only other occupants, 2 men at the far end of the row, spent much of each day and evening jabbering. Both were doing 30 days for starting a fight, which ended in broken bar mirrors and a few bones, over who could spit the farthest at the doggone beer hall. Mostly they lay on their beds, calling to each other from their adjoining cells, sounding like drum squatters. Much of the banter was gossip they'd heard about Kaya's case from their visitors, especially her odds of getting the death penalty, which had not been issued in the county for 20 years, and never to a woman. Kaya heard every word. Being dead didn't bother her. They couldn't scare her with threats of ending this shadow life. But the process of being killed by another's hand, planned out and set to schedule, was so unthinkable it stopped her breath. Sleep avoided her, slinking around the edges, then darting away. Her mind would plunge along deep walls of sudden slumber, an instant of bliss, then her body would shudder her awake. She stepped down from the crate and sat on the bed, knees tucked under her chin. They'd brought her here after court, so it might be 6 by now. Only 1 hour passed. Or maybe not even that. Chapter 43. A Microscope. 1969. In early September, more than a week after Chase attacked her, she walked down her beach. The wind ripped at a letter in her hand, so she held it against her breasts. Her editor had invited her to meet him in Greenville, writing that he understood she didn't come to town often, but he wanted to meet her, and the publisher would pay her expenses. The day stood clear and hot, so she motored into the marsh. At the end of a narrow estuary, she rounded a grassy bend and saw Tate squatting on a wide sandbar, dipping up water samples in little vials. His cruiser Coombe Research vessel was tied to a log and drifted across the channel, blocking it. She heaved on the tiller. Some of the swelling and bruising on her face had diminished, but ugly green and purple splotches still circled her eye. She panicked. She could not let Tate see her battered face, and tried to turn her boat around quickly. But he looked up and waved.
"Pull in, Kaya. I've got a new microscope to show you."
This had the same effect as the truant officer calling to her about chicken pie. She slowed, but didn't answer.
"Come on. You won't believe this magnification. You can see the pseudopods on the amoebas."
She'd never seen an amoeba, certainly not its body parts. And seeing Tate again brought a peace, a calmness. Deciding that she could keep her bruised face turned away from him, she beached her boat and walked through the shallow water toward his. She wore cut-off jeans and a white t-shirt, her hair free. Standing at the top of the stern ladder, he held out his hand and she took it, looking away from him. The cruiser's soft beige blended into the marsh, and Kaya had never seen anything as fine as the teak deck and brass helm.
"Come on down," he said,
stepping below into the cabin. She scanned the captain's desk, the small kitchen outfitted better than her own, and the living area that had been converted into an onboard laboratory with multiple microscopes and racks of vials. Other instruments hummed and blinked. Tate fiddled with the largest microscope and adjusted the slide.
"Here, just a minute."
He touched a drop of marsh water onto the slide, covered it with another, and focused the eyepiece. He stood.
"Have a look."
Kaya leaned over gently, as if to kiss a baby. The microscope's light reflected in her dark pupils, and she drew in a breath as a Mardi Gras of costumed players pirouetted and careened into view. Unimaginable headdresses adorned astonishing bodies, so eager for more life, they frolicked as though caught in a circus tent, not a single bead of water. She put her hand on her heart.
"I had no idea there were so many, and so beautiful," she said, still looking.
He identified some odd species, then stepped back, watching her.
"She feels the pulse of life," he thought, "because there are no layers between her and her planet."
He showed her more slides. She whispered,
"It's like never having seen the stars, then suddenly seeing them."
"Would you like some coffee?"
he asked softly. She raised her head.
"No, no, thank you."
Then she backed away from the microscope, moving toward the galley. Awkwardly, keeping her brown-green eye turned away. Tate was accustomed to Kaya being guarded, but her behavior seemed more distant and stranger than ever, continuously keeping her head turned at an angle.
"Come on, Kaya. Just have a cup of coffee."
He'd already moved into the kitchenette, and poured water into a machine that dripped out a strong brew. She stood by the ladder to the deck above, and he handed her a mug, motioning for her to go up. He invited her to sit on the cushioned bench, but she stood at the stern. Cat-like, she knew the exit. The brilliant white sandbar curved away from them under sheltering oaks.
Kaya?
He started to ask a question, but when she faced him, he saw the fading bruise on her cheek.
What happened to your face?
He walked toward her, reaching to touch her cheek. She turned away.
Nothing. I ran into a door in the middle of the night.
He knew that wasn't true by the way she flung her hand to her face. Someone had hit her. Had it been Chase? Was she still seeing him, even though he was married? Tate worked his jaw. Kaya moved to put her mug down, as if she were going. He forced calm. Have you started a new book?
I'm almost finished with the one on mushrooms. My editor's coming to Greenville sometime at the end of October and wants me to meet him there, but I'm not sure.
You should go. It'd be good to meet him. There's a bus from Barkley every day, one at night, too. It doesn't take long. 1 hour and 20 minutes, maybe, something like that.
I don't know where to buy a ticket.
The driver'll know everything. Just show up at the bus stop on Main. He'll tell you what you need to do. I think Jumpin' has a schedule tacked up in his store.
He almost mentioned that he had ridden the bus many times from Chapel Hill, but thought it better not to remind her of those days, of her waiting on a July beach. They were quiet for a while, sipping their coffee, listening to a pair of hawks whistling along the walls of a tall cloud. He hesitated to offer more coffee, knowing she would leave if he did. So he asked about her mushroom book, explained the protozoans he studied. Any bait to keep her. The afternoon light softened and a cool wind picked up. Putting the mug down again, she said,
I have to go.
I was thinking of opening some wine. Would you like some?
No, thanks.
Wait a second before you go,
Tate said as he went below to the galley and returned with a bag of leftover bread and biscuits.
Please give my regards to the gulls.
Thanks.
She climbed down the ladder. As she walked toward her boat, he called out,
Kaya, it's gotten cooler. Don't you want a jacket or something?
No, I'm fine.
Here, at least take my cap.
And he tossed a red ski cap toward her. She caught it and slung it back to him. He threw it again, farther, and she jogged across the sandbar, leaned low, and scooped it up. Laughing, she jumped into her boat, cranked the motor, and as she boated near him, pitched the hat back into his boat. He grinned, and she giggled. Then they stopped laughing and simply looked at each other as they lobbed the cap back and forth until she motored around the bend. She sat down hard on the stern seat and put her hand over her mouth.
No,
she said out loud.
I cannot fall for him again. I will not get hurt all over again.
Tate stayed at the stern, clenching his fists at the image of someone hitting her. She hugged the coastline just beyond the surf, heading south. On this route, she would pass her beach before reaching the channel that led through the marsh to her shack. Usually, she didn't stop at her beach, but motored through the maze of waterways to her lagoon, and then walked to the shore. But as she passed by, the gulls spotted her and swarmed the boat. Big Red landed on the bow, bobbing his head. She laughed.
Okay, then. You win.
Breaking through the surf, she beached her boat behind tall sea oats and stood at the shoreline, tossing the crumbs Tate had given her. As the sun spread golden pink across the water, she sat on the sand while the gulls settled around her. Suddenly, she heard a motor. and saw Chase's ski boat racing toward her channel. He could not see her boat behind the sea oats, but she was in plain sight on the open sand. Instantly, she lay flat, turning her head to the side so she could watch him. He stood at the helm, hair blowing back, face in an ugly scowl. But he didn't look in her direction as he turned into the channel toward her shack. When he was out of sight, she sat up. If she hadn't beached here with the gulls, he would have caught her at home. She'd learned over and over from Pa. These men had to have the last punch. Kaya had left Chase sprawled on the dirt. The two old fishermen had probably seen her flatten him. As Pa would have it, Kaya had to be taught a lesson. As soon as he discovered she wasn't at the shack, he'd walk here to her beach. She ran to her boat, throttled up, and headed back toward Tate. But she didn't want to tell Tate what Chase had done to her. Shame overwhelmed reason. She slowed down and drifted on swells as the sun disappeared. She had to hide and wait for Chase to leave. If she didn't see him go, she wouldn't know when it was safe to motor home. She turned into the channel, panicked that he could roar in her direction at any second. Her motor just above idle so she could hear his boat, she eased into a backwater thicket of overhanging trees and brush. She reversed deeper into the undergrowth, pushing limbs aside until layers of leaves and the falling night hid her. Breathing hard, she listened. Finally, she heard his engine screaming across the soft evening air. She ducked lower as he approached, suddenly worried that the tip of her boat was visible. The sound came very close, and in seconds, his boat zoomed by. She sat there for nearly 30 minutes until it was truly dark, then cruised home by starlight. She took her bedding to the beach and sat with the gulls. They paid her no mind, preening outstretched wings before settling down on the sand like feathered stones. As they chortled softly and tucked their heads for the night, she lay as close to them as she could get. But even among their soft cooing and ruffling, Kaya couldn't sleep. Mostly, she tossed from one side to the other, sitting up each time the wind mimicked footfalls. Dawn surf roared on a slapping wind that stung her cheeks. She sat up among the birds, who wandered nearby, stretching and kick-scratching. Big Red, eyes wide, neck cocked, seemed to have found something most interesting in his underwing, an act that would normally have made Kaya laugh. But the birds brought her no cheer. She walked to the water's edge. Chase would not let this go. Being isolated was one thing, living in fear, quite another. She imagined taking one step after the other into the churning sea, sinking into the stillness beneath the waves, strands of her hair suspending like black watercolor into the pale blue sea, her long fingers and arms drifting up toward the backlit blaze of the surface. Dreams of escape, even through death, always lift toward the light. The dangling, shiny prize of peace just out of grasp, until finally her body descends to the bottom and settles in murky quiet. Safe. Who decides the time to die? Chapter 44. Cellmate. 1970. Kaya stood in the middle of her cell. Here she was, in jail. If those she'd loved, including Jody and Tate, hadn't left her, she wouldn't be here. Leaning on someone leaves you on the ground. Before being arrested, she'd caught glimpses of a path back to Tate, an opening of her heart, love lingering closer to the surface. But when he'd come to visit her in jail on several occasions, she had refused to see him. She wasn't sure why jail had closed her heart even tighter, why she hadn't embraced the comfort he could give her in this place. It seemed that now, Kaya being more vulnerable than ever, was reason to trust others even less. Standing in the most fragile place of her life, she turned to the only net she knew, herself. Being thrown behind bars with no bail made clear how alone she was. The sheriff's offer of a phone call starkly reminded her. There was no one to call. The only phone number she knew in the world was Jody's. And how could she call her brother and say she was in jail accused of murder? After all those years, how could she bother him with her troubles? And maybe shame played a part. They had abandoned her to survive and defend herself. So here she was, by herself. Once more, she lifted the wondrous shell book Tom Milton had given her, by far her most treasured volume. Some biology texts were stacked on the floor, which the guard said Tate had brought, but she couldn't hold the words in place. Sentences wandered off in several directions, circling back to the beginning. Shell pictures were easier. Footsteps clanked on the cheap tile floor, and Jacob, a small black man who served as guard, appeared in front of her door. He held a large brown paper package.
"Sorry to bother you, Miss Clark, but you got a visitor. You got to come with me."
"Who is it?"
"It's your lawyer, Mr. Milton."
Metal-to-metal clanks sounded as Jacob unlocked her door and handed her the package.
"And this here's from Jumpin'."
She laid the parcel on the bed and followed Jacob down the hall and into a room, even smaller than her cell. Tom Milton rose from his chair as she entered. Kaya nodded at him, and then looked out the window, where an enormous cumulus cloud with peach-colored cheeks puffed itself up.
"Good evening, Kaya."
"Mr. Milton."
"Kaya, please call me Tom. And what's wrong with your arm? Have you hurt yourself?"
She jerked her hand, covering the webs she'd scratched on her arms.
"Just mosquito bites, I think."
"I'll talk to the sheriff. You shouldn't have mosquitoes in your room."
Head down, she said.
"Please, no, it's okay. I'm not worried about insects."
"All right. Of course I won't do anything you don't want. Kaya, I came to talk about your options."
"What options?"
"I'll explain. It's hard to know at this point how the jury is leaning. The prosecution has a good case. It's not solid by any means, but considering how people in this town are prejudiced, you have to be prepared that it won't be easy for us to win. But there's the option of a plea bargain. Do you know what I'm referring to?"
"Not exactly."
"You have pleaded not guilty to first-degree murder. If we lose, you lose big. Life in prison, or, as you know, they are seeking the death penalty. Your option is to plead guilty to a lesser charge, say manslaughter. If you were willing to say yes, you did go to the tower that night, you did meet Chase there, you had a disagreement, and in a horrible accident he stepped backward through the grate, the trial might end immediately. You wouldn't have to go through any more of this drama, and we could negotiate with the prosecution over a sentence. Since you've never been charged with anything before, they'd probably sentence you to 10 years, and you could be out in, say, 6 years. I know that sounds bad, but it's better than spending life in prison or the other."
"No, I won't say anything that implies guilt. I will not go to prison."
"Kaya, I understand, but please take some time to think about it. You don't want to live your entire life in jail, nor do you want the other."
Kaya looked out the window again.
"I don't need to think about it. I won't stay in jail."
"Well, we don't have to decide now. We have some time. Let's see how it goes. Before I leave, is there anything you want to discuss with me?"
Please get me out of here, one way or the other.
I'll do my best to get you out, Kaya, but don't give up. And please help me. Like I've mentioned before, you need to be engaged. Look at the jurors now and then.
But Kaya had turned to leave. Jacob led her back to the cell, where she picked up the package from Jumpin', unwrapped by the warden and taped up haphazardly again. She opened it, saving and folding the paper. Inside was a basket with some tiny vials of paint, a brush, paper, and a paper bag of Mabel's corn muffins. The basket was lined with a nest of pine straw, some oak leaves, a few shells, and long strands of cattails.
Kaya sniffed deeply, pinched her lips. Jumpin'. Mabel.
The sun had set, no dust motes to follow. Later, Jacob cleared away her supper tray.
I declare, Miss Clark, you didn't eat much at all. Them poke chops and greens as good as they get.
She smiled lightly at him, then listened as his steps clumped to the end of the hall. She waited to hear the thick metal door shut with heavy finality. Then something moved on the hall floor, just outside the bars. Her eyes swung there. Sunday Justice sat on his haunches, staring at her dark eyes with his green ones.
Her heart raced. Locked up alone all these weeks, and now this creature could step wizard-like between the bars. Be with her.
Sunday Justice broke the stair and looked down the hall, toward the inmates' talk. Kaya was terrified that he would leave her and walk to them. But he looked back at her, blinked in obligatory boredom, and squeezed easily between the bars. Inside. Kaya breathed out. Whispered,
"Please stay."
Taking his time, he sniffed his way around the cell, researching the damp cement walls, the exposed pipes, and the sink, all the while compelled to ignore her. A small crack in the wall was the most interesting to him. She knew because he flicked his thoughts on his tail. He ended his tour next to the small bed. Then, just like that, he jumped onto her lap and circled, his large white paws finding soft purchase on her thighs. Kaya sat frozen, her arms slightly raised, so as not to interfere with his maneuvering. Finally, he settled as though he had nested here every night of his life. He looked at her. Gently, she touched his head, then scratched his neck. A loud purr erupted like a current. She closed her eyes at such easy acceptance. A deep pause in a lifetime of longing. Afraid to move, she sat stiff until her leg cramped, then shifted slightly to stretch her muscles. Sunday Justice, without opening his eyes, slid off her lap and curled up next to her side. She lay down fully clothed, and they both nestled in. She watched him sleep, then followed, not falling toward a jolt, but a drifting, finally, into an empty calm. Once during the night, she opened her eyes and watched him sleeping on his back, forepaws stretched one way, hind paws the other. But when she awoke at dawn, he was gone. A moan struggled against the strength of her throat. Later, Jacob stood outside her cell, holding the breakfast tray with one hand, unlocking the door with the other.
"Gotcha your oatmeal, Miss Clark."
She took the tray, saying,
"Jacob, the black and white cat that sleeps in the courtroom, he was here last night."
"Oh, sorry as can be. That's Sunday Justice. Sometimes he slips in with me, and I don't see him 'cause I carry in the supper trays. I end up closing him in with y'all."
Kind enough not to say locking.
"It's fine. I liked having him here. Please, will you let him in whenever you see him after supper, or any time?"
He looked at her with soft eyes,
Course I can. I'll do that, Miss Clark. I sure will. Can see he'd be mighty good company.
Thank you, Jacob.
That evening, Jacob returned.
Here's your food now, Miss Clark. Fried chicken, mashed taters with gravy from the diner. Hope you can eat some of them tonight now.
Kaya stood, looking around his feet. She took the tray.
Thank you, Jacob. Have you seen the cat?
No, not at all. But I'll keep an eye out.
Kaya nodded. She sat on the bed, the only place to sit, and stared at the plate. Here in jail was better food than she had seen all her life. She poked around the chicken, pushed the butter beans. Having found food, her stomach was lost. Then, the sound of the lock turning, the heavy metal door swinging. At the end of the hall, she heard Jacob say,
"There you go, then, Mr. Sunday Justice."
Without breathing, Kaya stared at the floor outside her cell, and within a few seconds, Sunday Justice stepped into view. His markings were surprisingly stark and soft at the same time. No hesitation this time, he stepped into her cell and walked up to her. She put the plate on the floor, and he ate the chicken, pulled the drumstick right onto the floor, then lapped up the gravy. Skip the butter beans. She smiled through it all, then wiped the floor clean with tissue. He jumped on her bed, and a sweet sleep wrapped them together. Jacob stood outside her door the next day.
"Miss Clark, you got another visitor."
"Who is it?"
"It's Mr. Tate again. He's done come several times now, Miss Clark. Either bring something or ask to see you. Won't you see him today, Miss Clark? It's Saturday. No court, nothing to do in here the livelong day."
"All right, Jacob."
Jacob led her to the same dingy room where she had met Tom Milton. As she stepped through the door, Tate rose from his chair and walked quickly toward her. He smiled lightly, but his eyes revealed the sadness from seeing her here.
"Kaya, you look good. I've been so worried. Thank you for seeing me. Sit down."
They sat opposite each other, while Jacob stood in the corner reading a newspaper with considerate concentration.
"Hello, Tate. Thanks for the books you brought."
She acted calm, but her heart pulled into pieces.
"What else can I do for you?"
"Maybe you could feed the gulls if you're out my way."
He smiled.
"Yes, I've been feeding them, every other day or so."
He made it sound easygoing, but had driven or boated to her place every dawn and dusk to feed them.
"Thank you."
"I was in court, Kaya, sitting right behind you. You never turned around, so I didn't know if you knew that. But I'll be there every day."
She looked out of the window.
"Tom Milton's very good, Kaya. Probably the best lawyer in this part of the state. He'll get you out of here. Just hang on."
When again she didn't speak, he continued.
"And as soon as you're out of here, we'll get back to exploring lagoons like in the old days."
"Tate, please. You have to forget me."
"I have never and will never forget you, Kaya."
"You know I'm different. I don't fit with other people. I cannot be part of your world. Please, can't you understand? I'm afraid to be close with anybody ever again. I can't."
"I don't blame you, Kaya, but..."
"Tate, listen to me. For years I longed to be with people. I really believed that someone would stay with me, that I would actually have friends and a family, be part of a group. But no one stayed. Not you or one member of my family. Now I've finally learned how to deal with that and how to protect myself, but I can't talk about this now. I appreciate your coming to see me in here, I do,
and maybe someday we can be friends. But I can't think about what comes next. Not in here.
Okay, I understand. Really, I do.
After a short silence, he continued.
The great horns are already calling.
She nodded, almost smiled.
Oh, and yesterday when I was at your place, you won't believe it, but a male Cooper's hawk landed right on your front steps.
Finally, a smile as she thought of the coop, one of her many private memories.
Yes, I believe it.
10 minutes later, Jacob said their time was up, and Tate had to leave. Kaya thanked him again for coming.
I'll keep feeding the gulls, Kaya, and I'll bring you some books.
She shook her head and followed Jacob. Chapter 45 Red Cap, 1970. On Monday morning, after Tate's visit, when Kaya was led into the courtroom by the bailiff, she kept her eyes away from the spectators, as she had before, and looked deep into the shadowy trees outside. But she heard a familiar sound, maybe a soft cough, and turned her head. There, in the first row of seats, sitting with Tate, were Jumpin and Mabel, who wore her church bonnet decked out with silk roses. Folks had made a stir when they walked in with Tate and sat downstairs in the white area. But when the bailiff reported this to Judge Sims, still in his chambers, the judge told him to announce that anybody of color or creed could sit anywhere they wanted in his courtroom, and if somebody didn't like it, they were free to leave. In fact, he'd make sure they did. On seeing Jumpin and Mabel, Kaya felt a smidge of strength, and her back straightened slightly. The next witness for the prosecution, Dr. Stuart Cohn, the coroner, had graying hair cut very short and wore glasses that sat too far down his nose, a habit that forced him to tilt his head back to see through the lenses. As he answered Eric's questions, Kaya's mind wandered to the gulls. These long months in jail, she had pined for them. Yet all along, Tate had been feeding them. They had not been abandoned. She thought of Big Red, how he always walked across her toes when she threw crumbs to them. The coroner tossed his head back to adjust his glasses, the gesture bringing Kaya back to the courtroom.
So, to recap, you've testified that Chase Andrews died between midnight and 2 o'clock on the night of October 29th or the morning of the 30th, 1969. The cause of death was extensive injuries to the brain and spinal cord due to a fall through an open grate of the fire tower 63 feet to the ground. As he fell, he hit the back of his head on a support beam, a fact confirmed by blood and hair samples taken from the beam. Is all that correct, according to your expert opinion? Yes. Now, Dr. Cohn, why would an intelligent and fit young man like Chase Andrews step through an open grate and fall to his death? To rule out one possibility, was there alcohol or any other substance in his blood that could have impaired his judgment? No, there was not. Evidence presented previously demonstrates that Chase Andrews hit the back of his head on that support beam, not his forehead.
Eric stood in front of the jury and took a large step.
But when I step forward, my head ends up slightly ahead of my body. Were I to step into a hole here in front of me, the momentum and the weight of my head would pitch me forward, correct? Chase Andrews would have hit his forehead on the beam, not the back of his skull, if he was stepping forward. So, isn't it true, Dr. Cohn, that the evidence suggests that Chase was going backward when he fell?
Yes, the evidence would support that conclusion. So we can also conclude that if Chase Andrews was standing with his back to the opened grate and was pushed by someone, he would have fallen backward, not forward.
Before Tom could object, Eric said very quickly,
I'm not asking you to state that this is conclusive evidence that Chase was pushed backward to his death. I am simply making it clear that if someone pushed Chase backward through the hole, the wounds to his head from the beam would have coincided with those actually found. Is that correct? Yes. All right, Dr. Cohn. When you examined Chase Andrews in the clinic, the morning of October 30th, was he wearing a shell necklace? No.
To suppress the rising nausea, Kaya focused on Sunday Justice grooming himself on a windowsill. Pretzeled into an impossible position, one leg straight in the air, he licked the inside tip of his tail. His own bath seemed to absorb and entertain him entirely. A few minutes later, the prosecutor was asking,
Is it correct that Chase Andrews wore a denim jacket the night he died? Yes, that is correct. And according to your official report, Dr. Cohn, did you not find red wool fibers on his jacket? Fibers that were not from any piece of clothing he was wearing? Yes.
Eric held up a clear plastic bag containing bits of red wool.
Are these the red fibers that were found on Chase Andrews's jacket? Yes.
Eric lifted a larger bag from his desk.
And isn't it true that the red wool fibers found on Chase's jacket matched those on this red cap?
He handed it to the witness.
Yes, these are my labeled samples, and the fibers from the cap and jacket matched exactly. Where was this cap found? The sheriff found the cap in Miss Clark's residence.
This was not generally known, and murmurs rippled through the crowd.
Was there any evidence that she had ever worn the cap? Yes, strands of Miss Clark's hair were found in the cap.
Watching Sunday Justice in court got Kaya thinking about how her family had never had a pet. Not one dog or cat. The only thing close was the female skunk, a silky, slinky, and sassy creature who lived under the shack. Ma called her Chanel. After a few near misses, they'd all gotten to know one another, and Chanel became very polite, only flashing her armament when the kids got too rowdy. She'd come and go, sometimes within feet of whoever was coming up or down the brick and boards. Every spring, she'd escort her little kits on forays into the oak woods and along the slip streams, them scurrying behind, running into and over one another in black and white confusions. Pa, of course, was always threatening to get rid of her, but Jody, showing maturity far beyond his father's, deadpanned,
Another one'll just move in, and I always reckoned it's better the skunk you know than the skunk you don't know.
She smiled now, thinking of Jody, then caught herself.
So Dr. Cohn, on the night Chase Andrews died, the night he fell backward through an open grate, a posture consistent with being pushed by someone, fibers on his jacket came from a red cap found at Miss Clark's residence, and there were strands of Miss Clark's hair in the cap. Yes. Thank you, Dr. Cohn. I have no further questions.
Tom Milton looked briefly at Kaya, who watched the sky. The room leaned physically toward the prosecution as though the floor tipped, and it didn't help that Kaya sat rigid and detached, carved from ice. He flicked his white hair from his forehead and approached the coroner for the cross-examination.
Good morning, Dr. Cohn. Good morning. Dr. Cohn, you testified that the wound on the back of Chase Andrews's head was consistent with him going backward through the open hole. Isn't it true that if he stepped backward on his own and fell through the hole by accident, the results of hitting the back of his head would have been exactly the same? Yes. Were there any bruises on his chest or arms that would coincide with him being pushed or shoved? No, There was, of course, heavy bruising over his entire body from the fall, mostly on the back of his body and legs. There were none that could be identified specifically as developing from a push or shove. In fact, isn't it true that there is no evidence whatsoever that Chase Andrews was pushed into the hole? That is true. There's no evidence that I'm aware of that Chase Andrews was pushed. So, Dr. Cohn, there is no evidence, from your professional examination of Chase Andrews's body, that proves this was a murder and not an accident? No.
Tom took his time letting this answer sink into the jury, then continued.
Now, let's talk about those red wool fibers found on Chase's jacket. Is there any way to determine how long the fibers had been on the jacket? No, we can say where they came from, but not when. In other words, those fibers could have been on that jacket for a year, even 4 years. That's correct. Even if the jacket had been washed. Yes. So there's no evidence that those fibers became attached to that jacket the night Chase died. No. There has been testimony that the defendant knew Chase Andrews for 4 years prior to his death. So you're saying that any time during those 4 years when they met wearing those items of clothing, it's possible the fibers were transferred from the cap to the jacket? From what I have seen, yes. So the red fibers do not prove that Miss Clark was with Chase Andrews the night he died. Was there any evidence at all that Miss Clark was in close proximity to Chase Andrews that night? For example, her skin fragments on his body, under his fingernails, or her fingerprints on the buttons or snaps of his jacket? Strands of her hair on his clothes or body? No. So in fact, since the red fibers could have been on his jacket for as long as 4 years, there's no evidence whatsoever that Miss Catherine Clark was near Chase Andrews the night of his death? From my examination, that is correct. Thank you. No more questions.
Judge Sims declared an early lunch recess. Tom touched Kaya's elbow gently and whispered that it had been a good cross-examination. She nodded slightly as people stood and stretched. Almost all stayed long enough to watch Kaya being handcuffed and led from the room. As Jacob's steps echoed down the hall after leaving her in her cell, Kaya sat hard on her bed. When she was first incarcerated, they hadn't allowed her to bring her knapsack into the cell, but let her take some of its contents with her in a brown paper bag. She reached into the bag then and pulled out the scrap of paper with Jody's phone number and address. Since being there, she'd looked at it almost every day and thought of phoning her brother, asking him to come be with her. She knew he would, and Jacob had said she could use the phone to call him. But she had not. How would she say the words, "Please come, I'm in jail, charged with murder"? Carefully, she put the paper back into the bag and lifted out the World War I compass Tate had given her. She let the needle swing north and watched it settle true. She held it against her heart. Where else would one need a compass more than in this place? Then she whispered Emily Dickinson's words. "The sweeping up the heart and putting love away, we shall not want to use again until eternity." Chapter 46, King of the World, 1969. The September sea and sky glistened pale blue from a soft sun as Kaya churned in her little boat toward Jumpin's to get the bus schedule. The thought of busing with strange people to a strange town unnerved her. But she wanted to meet her editor, Robert Foster. For more than 2 years, they had exchanged short notes, and even some long letters, mostly discussing editorial adjustments for the prose and art in her books. But the correspondence, written so often in biological phrases blended with poetic descriptions, had become a bond welded in its own language. She wanted to meet this person on the other end of the mail line, who knew how ordinary light is shattered by microscopic prisms in the feathers of hummingbirds, creating the iridescence of its golden red throat, and how to say it in words as startling as the colors. As she stepped onto the wharf, Jumpin greeted her and asked if she needed gas.
No, thanks. Not this time. I need to write down the bus schedule. You have a copy, right?
Sure do. Tacked up right on the wall left of the door. Help yourself.
After she stepped from the shop with the schedule, he asked,
You going on a trip somewheres, Miss Kyle?
I might. My editor invited me to Greenville to meet him. Not sure yet.
Well, then, that'll be mighty fine. It's a fur piece over there, but a trip'll do you good.
As Kaya turned to get back into her boat, Jumpin leaned in and looked at her more closely.
Miss Kaya, what's done happened to your eye? Your face? Look like you've been beat up, Miss Kaya.
Quickly, she turned her face away. The bruise from Chase's slug, almost a month old, was faded to a faint yellowish stain, which Kaya thought no one would notice.
No, I just walked into a door and...
Don't you go telling me a story now, Miss Kaya. I didn't just fall off the turnip truck. Who done hit you like that?
She stood silent.
Was it Mr. Chase done this to you? You know you can tell me. In fact, we gonna stand right here till you tell me.
Yes, it was Chase.
Kaya could barely believe the words came from her mouth. She never thought she had anyone to tell such things. She turned away again, fighting tears. Jumpin's entire face frowned. He didn't speak for several seconds, and then...
What else he'd done?
Nothing, I swear. He tried jumping, but I fought him off.
That man's got to be horse-whipped, then run out of this town.
Jumpin', please. You can't tell anybody. You know you can't tell the sheriff or anybody. They'd drag me into the sheriff's office and make me describe what happened to a bunch of men. I can't live through that.
Kaya dropped her face in her hands.
Well, something got to be done. He can't go and do a thing like that and then just go on boating round in that fancy boat of his. King of the world.
Jumpin', you know how it is. They'll take his side. They'll say I'm just stirring up trouble, trying to get money out of his parents or something. Think what would happen if one of the girls from Colored Town accused Chase Andrews of assault and attempted rape. They'd do nothing. Zero.
Kaya's voice became more and more shrill.
It would end in big trouble for that girl. Write-ups in the newspaper, people accusing her of whoring. Well, it'd be the same for me, and you know it. Please. Promise me you won't tell anybody.
She ended in a sob.
You're right, Miss Kaya. I know you're right. You don't got to worry about me doing anything to make this thing worse. But how do you know he ain't coming after you again? And you're always on your lonesome out there.
I've always protected myself before. I just slipped up this time because I didn't hear him coming. I'll stay safe, Jumpin'. If I decide to go to Greenville, when I come back, maybe I could live out at my reading cabin a while. I don't think Chase knows about it.
All right, then. But I want you to come in here more often. I want you to come by and let me know how things are going. You know you can always come out and stay with Mabel and me. You know that.
Thank you, Jumpin'. I know.
When you going over to Greenville?
I'm not sure. The editor's letter mentioned late October, I haven't made arrangements.